The topic today, why capitalism breeds war.
Well, it's all about the Marxist theory of imperialism, which I think is one of the central questions in the world today around why there seems to be endless war. You think Iraq and Afghanistan and now Libya, or, you know, you think about the fact that over the last 110 years now, there has not been a single day of world peace. There's always been a war raging somewhere. War has become a constant feature of capitalism, and I would argue it would continue to be so until we get rid of the system. To put, you know, the priorities of the system in perspective, I guess, according to the Stockholm International Peace Research Foundation, which are a sort of respected NGO-type group, world military spending, openly declared world military spending last year, was about $1.6 trillion. Now, that sounds high. But it's a massive underestimate because, well, it's the openly declared military spending, the things that governments put in their military budgets at the start of each year. So the tens and hundreds of billions of dollars the US has spent invading Iraq and Afghanistan, for instance, none of this goes into their main military budget. Most of it's got through various votes in Congress and things. So the actual figure of world military spending would run into the trillions of dollars. And this is all in a world where people starve regularly for lack of access to food, for lack of access to resources and all the rest. The US military budget on its own accounts for roughly half of the entire world military budget, hundreds of billions in the US alone, in a country where there is a growing homeless problem. There are tent cities in the wake of the economic crisis and so on. In the last Australian budget, you would have seen military spending stayed up in the stratospheric heights, came down very, 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 a very small amount, but it's still up in the stratosphere. And I would expect that in the next budget as well, when we see swinging cuts to a whole lot of things that are necessities for people, military spending will remain at astronomical highs. It's the old quote that there is always money for guns under capitalism when there's no money for the rest of us. So what I'm going to argue is I'm going to put forward what the Marxist theory of imperialism is, because I think in contrast to a lot of the other explanations about why wars start and all of that, the only one that actually holds is imperialism, the Marxist theory. The only one that can explain the world is the Marxist theory of imperialism. So, well, I guess the one other thing to do before I launch right into it is how many people here went to the session yesterday about the state? Or the day before? One, two, cool. Well, all right, that'll determine what I do from here. All right, well, I guess the place to start then would be with some of the basic building blocks of capitalism, going back to what are the fundamental drivers of the capitalist system. And I think the first is that clearly it's a class-divided world we live in. Capitalism is a system that divides the world by class. So in Australia or any other given country, while the mass of the population, we're forced to sell our labour day by day in order to earn a wage or a salary or whatever, the people that call the shots, the people that own all the wealth and all the resources, and, you know, people that make money out of wars a lot of the time, well, they're not forced to sell their labour, are they? They, instead, the tiny minority at the top, what Marxists call the ruling class, they make their money by exploiting the rest of us. And this is very much their world. We just happen to work here in a certain sense. So you think, you know, Julia Gillard, for instance, done very little for the bulk of the population. I don't think that's particularly controversial. What she has done, though, is good things for the rich, good things for the ruling class of Australia, and things like that. So we live in a world where the tiny minority at the top have concentrated in their hands all the world's wealth, all the world's resources, and it's them that make the decisions around what the priorities of the system are, and it's for their benefit that the world is run. And it is in their interest that, you know, the world's governments and world states and all of that operate. You know, you just have to think about almost any example from Australian politics or world politics to see that, well, the state can be relied on all the time to screw the rest of us if it's in the interest of the rich. Think about the bank bailouts in the states and so on. All the money that never existed for health and education and all of that fell from the sky in its trillions once the banks were in trouble. So I think that's the first point to say about the system. that it's a class-divided system where the bulk of the population has almost no control over the direction of the world or its resources. But the second point is that the ruling class, the tiny minority at the top, well, they've all got a common interest in the sense that they all know that they live by exploiting the rest of us. They all know that massive tax cuts to the rich and all that are in their interests, and so on. But they all hate one another as well, because it's a competitive world. You know, Marx called them a band of warring brothers, in the sense that they have a common interest as a class. You know, they want to band together against the rest of us from time to time. But, you know, you think about the market and all of that. Well, it is a very competitive world. You think about the big businesses in Australia. The ones that leap to mind are, you know, the mining giants who dominate the Australian economy, Rio Tinto, BHP Billiton. All right, they both benefit from stopping things like the mining tax, but they both want to destroy one another. They're both at one another's throats and all of that. If you run a company or if you're one of the major shareholders in these companies, you know that you better do everything you can to drive the opposition out of business, to steal market share, to take their, you know, customer base or whatever. Otherwise, they'll do the same to you. So we have a world that's marked by both that class division, but where the ruling class are busy and locked in unending, you know, competition against one another, a ruthless competition that by definition can't let up. Because if you're the first company to let it, to stop, well, you'll get taken over, you'll get run out of business, you'll get driven into the ground, and so on. I think restating some of those very basic things about the capitalist system and how it runs, I think this is a prerequisite to understanding the theory of imperialism. Because you think, well, that explains, you know, the sort of day-by-day competition on the market and all of that that happens within countries and things. That explains why, you know, Fortescue Metals tries to, you know, negotiate deals to screw Rio Tinto and then fails miserably and all the rest. That explains why, you know, every business is trying to outcompete one another. But, and that was sort of the classic capitalism, I guess, that Marx described when he was writing about it in the middle of the 19th century. But things clearly have moved on, and Marx did identify a number of dynamics in the system that have been proven true over time. These days, I guess the buzzword for what I'm about to talk about is globalization, but this is nothing new. So that process of competition that I talked about, well, this means that businesses do get driven out of business. This means that, you know, companies try to take over their rivals and all of the rest. Over time, there is a dynamic within the system toward what Marx called the concentration and centralization of capital. That is where, you know, the most successful companies, they will take over their rivals and so on. They will expand. They will grow both in size, they'll also grow in scope and all of that. So they'll concentrate more, you know, well, there will be a centralization in short and that sort of thing. You see the rise over time of not just little individual businesses competing on, you know, sort of markets and all of that, but large-scale monopolies, or, you know, you think of the mining giants, which I'm going to keep coming back to as an example throughout this, you know, clearly these are major players in not just the Australian economy, but the world economy, because over time, you know, BHP Billiton's got a very good record of beating up its rivals, of expanding and all of that. They've established connections everywhere and all the rest. So, you know, since Marx's day, the process of centralization of capital and all of that, but also the spreading of the claws of individual monopolies and individual businesses worldwide has accelerated markedly. And I think I've got a quote here from Lenin when he was writing in his book, Imperialism, when he was writing in Imperialism, the High Stage of Capitalism, which I can recommend people read, where he describes this process. Half a century ago, he said, when Marx was writing Capital, free competition appeared to the overwhelming majority of economists to be the natural law. Marx had proved that free competition gives rise to the concentration of production, which in turn, at a certain stage of development, leads to monopoly. Today, monopoly has become a fact. The rise of monopolies as the result of the concentration of production is a general and fundamental law of the present stage of the development of capitalism. For Europe, and this was back in the early 1900s when Lenin was writing, The time when the new capitalism definitively superseded the old can be established with fair precision. It was the beginning of the 20th century. So he talking there that, well, by 1900 and so on, while the sort of individual competition that Marx described wasn't really the norm anymore. It was more about the competition between the major enterprises, the ones that dominate entire branches of industry, the ones that dominate, in some cases, you know, entire areas of the world and all of that. But there's another process alongside this that goes on, that while, you know, businesses get bigger and so on, reach out further, you know, in order to, you know, try and find markets and all the rest, in order to try and compete. Well, to do that effectively, they need to start establishing better relations with the state that they operate within. Because you think each sort of capitalist enterprise, it bases itself on a nation state because it needs, you know, a series of regulations and things that establish what their competitors can and can't do. It needs, you know, a body like the state that can have complete, that can have a monopoly over the use of force, so that they can have the police force and army and so on to keep their workers in line and things like that. But it also needs a state that can do things like, back to the mining giants, invest in the sort of massive transportation infrastructure that's needed to transport the iron ore in Australia from the mines to the ports and so on. It needs a state that's capable of directing investment to, you know, port infrastructure and all of that, things that are useful for the capitalists, but that no individual capitalist is going to go out on a whim and invest in, because then their rivals will be able to use it and they would have lost money and all the rest. So as this process of centralisation goes on, individual capitalists strive to try and get as best a relationship as possible that they can with their respective state. You know, they want an inside track and all of that. They want to have the ear of, in Australia, the Prime Minister and the Cabinet and all the rest, so they can make sure that various state investment decisions benefit them. But they can also make sure that on the world stage, the Australian state, when it goes around talking to its allies and its enemies, when it goes around bullying and all of that, acts in the interests of Australian capital, and particularly the leading sections of Australian capital, by which I mean sort of Australian big business. So there's a process where, you know, as this monopoly happens, the what was once the individual capitalists competing on the national market, well, they intertwine themselves more and more with the state and compete on an international market with the state doing their bidding. And I'll quote from Chris Harman, another wonderful theorist of Marxism, he passed away last year, but was a member of the British SWP until then. He said, "The system has always been composed of different individual capitals, each run by people who attempt to use their connections with each other and with the state to cheat the market. But under the free market capitalism of Marx's time, none was big enough to influence the dynamic of the system as a whole. By contrast, in Lenin's picture," the one he described in imperialism, the highest form of capitalism, "in Lenin's picture, individual capitals dominate each major section of production within each country, and are able, through their connections with each other and with the state, to impose a whole new dynamic of political and military expansionism on society as a whole." I'll sort of recap, and if we add all of that together, I think we can see and start to explain why, in contrast to a whole lot of, you know, previous pre-capitalist societies and so on, and in contrast particularly to the early days of capitalism, since about 1900, it has been non-stop war. Because the process I described, and it's a process that's part and parcel of capitalism, that's something that's inherent to capitalism itself, you know, the rise of monopolies and all of that. Well, this leads unavoidably to those big businesses and all of that trying to use their connections to compete internationally by any means necessary. So I think that means, you think about Australian big business again, well, the mining giants want to bully the South Pacific, because they want access to, for instance, Bougainville, if people remember some of the stuff around that. You know, they want access to the resources there and all of that. They want the trade routes that shipping goes through in the South Pacific to be cleared up. They don't want to pay any duties on shipping. They want the Australian government to go in and heavy the Egyptian government. They want them to go in and kick the crap out of the East Timorese government so that they get their way, so that Australian big business can dominate. Similarly, you think about, you know, the free trade agreements and so on that America what is undoubtedly the world's biggest imperial power, has imposed right around the world in all of this. This was the American state doing the bidding of American big business, because ultimately the American state is the creature of the American capitalist class, of American big business, just like the Australian state's a creature of Australian big business. They go around the world. Mexico would be one of the prime examples, and bully, heavy, blackmail and bribe, and in some cases use raw force to try and force other countries and all of that to give the best deals to America, to allow America to dominate the markets, American companies to dominate the markets, and so on. So what we see is international competition, which destroys millions of people's lives, obviously. This is part and parcel of capitalism. But international competition built in to the system at its very core, unavoidably part of capitalism. But of course, war, and even the sort of barbaric slaughter we saw in World War I and World War II, the dropping of atomic bomb on Japan and all of that, the 4.5 million refugees in Iraq, the millions dead from that war, well, this is just competition by another means, as far as the capitalists are concerned, isn't it? Ultimately, you know, just like when the capitalist power is threatened domestically, when people arc up against them, they'll use raw force, they'll send the police in and try and break up striking people at the Visy cardboard plant and all of that in Melbourne and things like that. Internationally, the capitalists are equally as prepared to use force against their rivals. So you think if there's a stalemate, the ultimate decision is going to be, you know, if there's two of the big, sort of empires fighting one another, if there's America and, say, the EU at loggerheads over who's going to get the best deal somewhere, ultimately what will decide that is who's got the biggest army, who's got more guns. Because if diplomacy can't do the trick, if espionage and all of that can't do the trick, if the tariff wars and so on that go on constantly can't do the trick, the capitalists are just as prepared to use arms against their rivals they're possibly more prepared to use it against their class enemies like, us and workers and all of that. But, history's shown that they don't have any particular problem with slaughtering hundreds of thousands of people to get their way. So what I was trying to do there was, I guess, draw together all the stuff I'd mentioned around the rise of monopoly, the way that the state acts as, the creature of capital, big business and all of that, to explain why, I guess, the wars that go on, these aren't simply a matter of policy. It's not simply a matter of, for instance, it used to be quite popular to think that, well, it's just George Bush being a lunatic. He's just particularly hawkish, particularly militarist and all of that. That's why he starts wars, same with John Howard and all of that. No. The picture I'm trying to paint, and I think it's an accurate one, given Obama's record and given, Julie Gillard and that, and Australian troops are still in the Middle East and things, is that, well, the wars we see, these are the inevitable outgrowth of just the day-to-day international competition on the world stage. So, my argument would be that imperialism, what we mean by imperialism is the international competition between the big world powers with, their respective sort of national blocks of capital, if you like, the respective national blocks of big businesses, each using their state and the resources that state can mobilize and the influence that state can mobilize against their rivals. So whether it is, you think about the currency war that's currently going on between America and China, with each trying to find a way to export themselves out of the economic crisis and all of that. Well, they're fighting. The US always makes all these statements around, the renminbi, the Chinese currency, this is massively undervalued and so on. Well, this is just international competition. And on one level, for the capitalists, I don't think they see this big distinction between a currency war and a shooting war. They know that one's kind of, easier to get away. You can have a currency war and it doesn't make world headlines and all of that. But they're perfectly prepared, as they have been time after time, to use guns when they need to, and to slaughter working class people if they need to, and so on. So, you just have to think about the last 100 years of capitalism. What have we seen? Well, World War One. Can anyone, actually, it's useful, can anyone think of what the justification was for World War One? Because I think the capitalists and the ideologues of the ruling class, they've pretty much given up on this one. What was World War One about? Anyone?
trade.
Well, yeah, that's right, ultimately. But what was the justification that was used? You know, we've got bringing democracy to the Middle East today.
Archduke Ferdinand. Yeah.
Yeah, so Archduke Ferdinand got shot. So a whole lot of people that never even met Archduke Ferdinand dug trenches across Europe and killed one another and so on. You know, they... So, okay, no one believes that. That's good. And I agree that ultimately it was about trade and empire building and all of that. You know, you had Germany, France, England and all the rest. All of them were champing at the bit. You know, they expanded. The whole world was taken up by capitalist powers and so on. There was no extra room to just go and expand like the old colonial days. If you were going to, you know, expand your influence, it was going to be butting heads against other capitalist powers and so on. That's World War One. That's the slaughter of hundreds of thousands of people in the trenches. That's the mustard gas and all of that. That's the capitalists of each individual European big power trying to expand against one another. World War II, I would argue, along much the same lines. I mean, if people want to read more about it than that, I just recommend reading Tom Lincoln's book. He's just churned out an entire book about Australia and the Pacific War and things. But, you know, you think the more recent wars, I think, are useful to look at because they draw out some of the main points about imperialism as opposed to just some of the other mainstream explanations for war. Iraq, Afghanistan, all the rest. On one level, people were right to say that it's about oil to a degree because, you know, the Middle East wouldn't be as important in the world if it didn't have huge resources, like huge supplies of oil and things. But going back to the theory of imperialism, well, ultimately, it's not like old-style colonialism. It's not that the big powers are just invading to loot places or anything. No, it's about competition between the big powers and all of that. So I think the best way to look at things like the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan was that, well, this wasn't the US going to war against Afghanistan so much. This was the US going to war against China, Russia, and the EU. You know, this was the US saying, well, we're number one on the world sort of pecking order. We've got more guns than everyone. Our economy is still reasonably strong, but it's, you know, we're not holding our ground. Here's an opportunity to try and dominate a section of the world that our other rivals want to dominate. And this will help us secure our number one spot in the pecking order. This will be a way of telling the EU, of telling China and its expanding economy, of telling Russia and its, you know, attempts to reassert its power to stay in their box, to say that America's still got the guns and all of that to dominate where they count. On one level, you know, Afghanistan, they were sort of in the wrong place at the wrong time. So I think that's the way to explain a lot of the, you know, the very convincing things that sometimes have got said around, well, there's no oil in Afghanistan. They spent billions of dollars invading the place. Well, this surely isn't good for capitalism. It's not about looting the place. It's about competing against their rivals. You know, that's why they did it. They did it so someone else couldn't. So, you know, it throws into very sharp relief, I think, the priorities of the system. That the lives of the people of an entire country, well, that's just sort of unfortunate for them because the US had an opportunity to flex its muscles and they were near where they got to flex it. Or, you know, you think Iraq, the million, more than a million dead as a direct result of the war and all of that. Millions of people displaced. People around Fallujah that are going to be suffering from generations of generations and generations of radiation deformities and so on thanks to depleted uranium when they leveled the city and things like that. Well, this is the US showing, you know, China and Russia and all of that, but they're still number one. And if you happen to live in Fallujah, well, tough. You know, you're just unlucky. So I think having a sense that the theory of imperialism is about the competition between the big powers, it tells us, it can explain a lot of the seeming lunacy of the system. Because you think they've spent more on the wars in the Middle East than they would need it if they just bought the oil. You know, if they went in with an offer to say, we'll buy every single bit of oil beneath the ground, it would have cost them less than they spent in total invading the place, and it would have been better PR. But no, you know, it wasn't ultimately about that. It's about the competition between the big powers and so on. So, you know, that's, I think, the real heart of the Marxist theory of imperialism. That's the thing that can start to explain why we see endless war and all of that in the world today, and why we can be sure that it will be endless war unless the system is stopped. Because I think knowing this, it means you don't fall into the traps that people have fallen into in the past. You know, there's a long history of people trying to argue that war isn't necessarily a feature of capitalism. goes back to, you know, the, as I was saying, the start of the 1900s and so on. But more recently, well, you think of that big anti-war campaign in the United States when the Iraq War started. One of the things that helped to massively demobilize it, that managed to make that anti-war campaign less effective, is because I think the dominant idea there was it was just about George Bush. So once George Bush is gone, the wars will be gone, because it's about George Bush and the cabal around him. It's not about the entirety of the American big business getting what they want and things. It's not about the state acting on behalf of the whole of American big business. So you had, I'm not sure if people remember this, it's a while ago now, but there was anyone but Bush was the sort of slogan of the anti-war campaign. It went from, you know, we need to stand up against war to we need to stand up against George Bush. Obama gets elected eventually. What changes? What changes? Nothing. If anything, he gets away with more drone attacks on people. He gets away with more than people would allow George Bush to get away with. Similarly, in Australia, because Australia is an imperial power too. It's not as big as the United States. Its enemies, you know, it knows it has to pick its fights more and things like that. But it wants to dominate its local region. And what has been the difference between John Howard, the hawkish neocon liberal, and the Labor government? Both of them have gone out of their way to, for instance, with Labor, kicking the crap out of the East Timorese government and things like that. You know, their attempts to get a warehouse for human beings, the asylum seeker jail essentially set up there to sweep people under the rug, their attempts to heavy the East Timorese government when they're going to sign a trade deal with China instead of with us a couple of years ago, where they essentially, you know, threatened to topple the East Timorese government if they dared go along with it, attempts to dominate around the region. Well, this is Australia marking its territory out against what it sees as its rivals, in particularly the Chinese capitalist class. You know, the last Australian defence white paper was all about how are we going to stop China getting into the South Pacific, because this is our area. We want this, and it's part of us, you know, making waves on the world stage and so on. So I think the Marxist theory of imperialism, to sum up, using, I guess, the explanation that it is at the heart of capitalism, it leads inexorably and inevitably from, you know, the concentration of capital that is a day by day, that's a result of day by day competition. You know, seeing this tells us that, well, war is at the heart of capitalism. It's going to be around for as long as capitalism is going to be around, and it's going to get worse for as long as we allow capitalism to be around, and so on. The sort of wars we see today, these are historically unprecedented and things. More people die today, more people get embroiled in war over the last 100 years than in any other time in human history, and so on. It's one of the biggest arguments to get rid of the system as a whole, and knowing where these wars come from and all of that, it tells you exactly how we can best fight back. It means levelling our fire against what the root cause is, and that is, in general, the capitalist system. But it means for people in Australia, one of our biggest enemies is the Australian rich and powerful and that, because the Australian rich and powerful is part of the imperialist system and all of that. But it also tells us that when struggles challenge capitalism, as they've been doing in the Middle East at the moment, these are the best way to combat imperialism as well. What has done the most to shake American dominance in the Middle East lately? Millions and millions of people standing up for their own rights and saying, well, we don't trust the local rich and powerful to run our lives for us anymore. We're not going to trust the Americans to do it either, and so on. What stopped the First World War? This was, you know, soldiers marching out of the trenches and saying, well, this war is for the bosses. There's nothing for me in this war. I haven't even met the people I'm shooting at. Stuff this. Pretty much. I'm not going to give my life for their profits and so on. So I think, you know, what we need to take from this is that war is a central feature of capitalism. It's going to get worse. The people have fought back before. We can fight back again. And ultimately, if there's a revolutionary situation, we can make the whole damn edifice of capitalism crumble and war along with it. Thanks.